You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 3rd, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, leaked draft opinion from the Supreme Court shows Roe v. Wade being overturned. Joining us on the program, Kiara M. Bridges, professor at the UC Berkeley School of Law, expert on both constitutional and reproductive law, and then professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law, Michelle Oberman, on the relationship between a ban on abortion and what actually happens when that happens. Also on the program today, Ohio and Indiana primary day. Yesterday, AOC endorsed Nina Turner. And in Ohio, Never Trumper Dolan could overtake J.D. Vance. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi ratchets up the war talk. U.S. official claims Russia looking to annex parts of Ukraine. U.S. government reclassifies WNBA star Brittany Griner as wrongfully detained by Russia. They will no longer wait to see how that plays out, but will begin negotiations. Amazon labor union undaunted after election loss in the second Staten Island warehouse. Accusations against Madison Cawthorn multiply, strikingly, in the wake of his revelations of Republican lawmaker orgies and drug use.
Curious. Makes you think what Biden could do to Manchin if he chose.
Fed poised to raise short-term interest rate by a half a point, just the beginning, as they try and increase worker anxiety. Former NYC cop convicted of assault in his January 6th case, three pro-Trump congressmen refused to testify to the January 6th committee. And New York City moves into a higher COVID risk category as of yesterday, soon to be coming to a city near you. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is a pretty disturbing day on some level. Joining me for that day, and not the reason for it being disturbing, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
Sorry, did not mean to do that.
No, it's all okay. Although, yeah, I mean, I'm feeling better this morning because I had the opportunity to sleep on it. But that was one of those moments last night where you see the news and we knew this was coming, right? But to have it actually happen, it was my heart was in my throat for a good part of last night.
And we're going to talk about this to some degree. I don't know what particular insights maybe our guests may have to this, but there is a question as to whom leaked this. The idea of a leak is not completely unprecedented, but a full brief, or I should say opinion or draft opinion, leaking this far in advance from when the court was going to be public on it is unprecedented. And here was the first reaction that we saw, at least in terms of protesters. This is out in front of the Supreme Court last night, after this leak showed up in Politico.
Let the sun go, baby! Go out! Let the sun go, baby!
not to be unexpected response, right? I mean, if someone said to me there was a leaked draft coming out saying that Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned, what's going to happen at the Supreme Court? You're going to get a bunch of protesters there. And the reason why I'm bringing this is because there's going to be a lot made about the leak. And certainly the right wing now has already begun to frame it as if it was leaked by some member of the court that is on the center left, if you will. Here is Mitch McConnell going right. And look, this happened like that.
Oh, yeah. Last night, I was checking out some right wing media. Ari Fleischer immediately saying this was an insurrection. And maybe we'll get to this from the left, whoever this leaker was. Like, they coalesced behind this anti-leaker talking point because they're banking on the fact that the media is so obsessed with norms and process that they'll run with it as well and make it a debate not about the theocracy that the right is trying to impose in this country, but about if it's right, whether or not this should have been leaked.
And it's also, I mean, look, the bottom line is it shouldn't have been leaked. It's not appropriate.
What do you mean?
It's just not appropriate. I mean, like it would not be appropriate for you guys to leak some internal document here. You work in there. You shouldn't do it. It's not like national security. It's not like there's no whistleblower situation here. It's not appropriate to leak. But the idea that it was necessarily a left, wing or a liberal leak, I think is one that we should make sure that we question. There's no doubt they're using this, the question of the leak, to distract.
I think this is incredibly newsworthy and important to leak.
Well,
I mean, it depends on the motivations of the person. Again, now we're having the conversation about the leak, but like,
well,
they wanted,
let's play McConnell's here because this is the accusation here.
And now, last night, a shocking, shocking new breach. Somebody, likely somebody inside the court itself, leaked a confidential internal draft to the press, almost certainly in an effort to stir up an inappropriate pressure campaign to sway an outcome. The radical left immediately rallied around the toxic stunt. The cheerleaders for partisan court packing applauded what they suggested was the work of, quote, a brave clerk, making a last-ditch Hail Mary attempt to cause a political firestorm and cause the court to reconsider. Liberals want to rip the blindfold off Lady Justice. They want to override impartiality with intimidation. They want to elevate mob rule over the rule of law.
They want to force Lady Justice to carry a baby to term. They want to force her pregnancy. Look, I don't think there's that much value in arguing whether it's appropriate or not for a clerk to leak draft opinions.
I mean, I think that it all rests on your respect for the institution of the Supreme Court, which I don't respect.
No, I don't have any respect for the institution of the Supreme Court, but the bottom line is you're going to take a job there. Presumably you do. And if you're going to work there, it's not appropriate. You got to let the process play out. But that's irrelevant. Honestly, at the end of the day, the appropriateness of it is irrelevant. Obviously, if they find out who it is, they're going to fire him. I don't think there is any type of law against leaking there any more than there would be here. But
we do here is not going to affect half the population.
Every single ruling that they do will have great impact in society. And the court would not function if every opinion was leaked. And so it can't be appropriate. I mean, who gets to choose which one is or is not? But again, I don't think that's the real story here. I think the real story is who leaked it and why. And it is far more likely, since just as a sheer numbers game, that you have far more right-wing clerks on that court with a 6-3 breakdown than you would left-leaning. So just as a sheer math question, the presumption should be it comes from the people either in the five supposedly five people voting to overturn Roe v. Wade. The sixth, Chief Justice John Roberts, claiming that he would just have gone, he would have ruled in favor of Mississippi, but not overturned Roe v. Wade, which seems to me to be an oxymoron. But why would someone leak this? One of the reasons could be what McConnell says, to create pressure on the court, which is highly unlikely. It's not like anybody voting to overturn Roe v. Wade would be like, I'm really shocked that this is a big deal with people. Of course there's going to be protests. My 14-year-old, my 16-year-old daughter could have anticipated that. What is more likely is that either there were members of that five that might have been on shaky grounds, and this was an attempt to make it look like they were buckling to pressure if they changed their vote, or they are already anticipating, this thing's written in February, it's 3 months later, they're anticipating a slightly less aggressive Alito ruling, and they want to set the parameters of what's happening. They want to be able to say, like, it's not as bad as you thought when they came out, because that's been the game the Republicans have been playing with restriction of abortion the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the motivations behind the leaker, but I think that there is a case to be made that they wanted to, or at the very least, the outcome was that the information, or the way that Alito was writing this opinion, was filled with citing Clarence Thomas' dissents, in which he claimed that abortion was a eugenics project against black people. Other extremist positions that included right for gay people to get married. It was both a thumb in the, what do you call it? What's the phrase? But it was both a repudiation, thumb in the eye of right, there we go. It's about thumb in the face. That's not it. Of Planned Parenthood v. Casey and Roe v. Wade, et cetera. So perhaps the leaker was trying to show that, no, they're not just going to try to tweak this. They're going for these privacy protections under the 14th Amendment very broadly. And John Roberts, Kavanaugh reportedly wanted to be a bit more diplomatic in their approach. I don't know. But I do know that there are throughout like the 20th century and recently, there are a lot of brave leakers who have revealed injustices within our institutions. And the fact that this is the first time that it's happening on the Supreme Court goes to show how politicized this institution is and how it should be seen as, in the same vein as leaks that come out of the
all
Senate,
I can say is I hope you maintain that the value of coming out and saying that it's okay to leak that is that when it turns out to have been a conservative who leaked it, who did it because strategically it made more sense for them, you're now on record saying it's okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, personally, like,
but what does this do? I mean, what precedent does this set that you're so worried about? I don't
understand.
I'm
not worried about the precedent being set. I just think that, like, it doesn't in any way, the leak is in no way helpful to fighting this. The bottom line is this was going to happen. The idea that we know about it now or then, in terms of, like, the impact of the citizenry to do anything about it is nil. And I don't know if it was leaked because this is going to diminish its power in the run-up to the 2022 election. If that was the thinking, which it might dissipate over the course of 5 months, 6 months, as opposed to it coming out in June, it might lock in those. And so in the main, do I think that draft opinions of the Supreme Court should be leaked? No. I mean, do I feel strongly about it? I don't care. It's really more about, like, why did someone do this? And what are the political implications going to be? And what are the implications on the ruling going to be? And so,
whatever the case is, there are going to be countless women, millions of women, particularly in red states, particularly non-white women, particularly poor women, who are going to be affected by this in more ways than we can ever imagine. Abortion will still be sought, but death, harm caused to the woman is going to increase 100%, and there are in between 13 and 26 states at the ready right now to ban abortion in this country, and it's going to happen as soon as this is official. So yes, just be ready for that, because this is a scary time, obviously.
And Michelle Oberman will walk us through the implications of that. We got some sponsors, and then we will be talking to Kira Bridges. Great ads today. Well,
there's no easy transition.
No, there is no way to easily transition to this. It helps you sleep, I guess, a little bit. You know, a while back we had another sponsor for betting, and a longtime sponsor. I appreciated their product, but we had some problems with the way that they were producing these things. So for a while, I've been searching around for better bedding, and we found it. Cozy Earth, the softest, most luxurious, and for me, the best temperature regulating sheets. That's the key. They are made from super soft viscose from bamboo. I don't know what viscose is, but it's bamboo. And so they're far more sustainable. They breathe, so you sleep at night at the perfect temperature all year round. They have thousands of five-star reviews. They have become the bedding of choice for apparently like interior designers.
Well, did I tell you I got the comforter? It just came in the mail.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I got the duvet for Mila.
The duvet, yeah. I got that.
The duvet or the comforter?
Isn't that the same thing?
No.
Okay.
The duvet is the comforter cover.
Okay, well, right. I got both.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't put it on my bed yet. I'm waiting until it gets like a little bit warmer, but I'm excited about it because it felt amazing.
I'm also going to, I think, get Mila a they have a bathrobe there. But Cozy Earth offers a 100-night sleep trial, which means you have up to 100 nights to sleep on it. You wash it, you try it out. If you're not completely in love with it, you just send it back for a full refund. There's a 10-year warranty, and Cozy Earth sheets come in four new colors. Check it out. For me, they're soft, but the best part is that the temperature is regulating because I get too hot when I sleep. For a limited time, you can save 35% off Cozy Earth bedding. 35%. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. Enter my special promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Save 35% now. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter MAJORITY at checkout for 35% off. And of course, on a day like today, we have high-speed internet. We got celebrities going to space. We got electric cars. However, our technology for cleaning ourselves after going to the bathroom has remained the same. This is, it's Emma's favorite dads.
Mm-hmm.
Step into the 21st century. Upgrade your bathroom routine. Start washing your bum with Hello Tushy bidets. Hello Tushy bidet attachment washes your bum, obviously, with a fresh water. It's a way better clean. Simply spray, pat dry. Attaches to your existing toilet. No electrician or plumber needed. It's super easy. If you can change a toilet seat, you can do this. It takes about 8 minutes. Cuts down on your toilet paper use by 80%. It will change the way you see your life. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. I want all of our listeners to have clean bums, of course.
Of course.
Visit HelloTushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping right now. It's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. And tag Hello Tushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. Great.
Sam's against leaks in more ways than one.
Wow. All right. Touche.
There we go.
Tushy. All right. Let's take a quick. We got. All right. All right. I want to welcome to the program Kiara Bridges. She is a constitutional and reproductive law expert and law professor at the UC Berkeley School of Law, and was a signer of the amicus brief for the Dobbs case, the Mississippi case that this brief was written about. Professor Bridges, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Slight correction, I wrote the brief.
We have a little bit of audio trouble. Give us 1 second.
Okay.
There you go. We got you.
Okay,
welcome
you got
to the
me?
Program. I'm here with Emma Biglin.
Oh, thank you for having me. I not only signed that brief, I wrote it. So.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I know it inside and out.
Apologies.
Oh, gosh, no worries.
All right. So just give us – this is a weird situation, isn't it? Because we don't really know how the court has ruled on this. Will you tell people what it is that was leaked? John Roberts has now confirmed it is legit. So that question has been tabled. Will you tell us what it is that we are reading? It's 60 some odd pages.
Yeah, no. So it appears to be the opinion of the court. So this would be the majority opinion that would be handed down sometime this summer. Usually the court opinions are handed down in the summer, so like June or July. But this opinion has not yet received responses from the other justices. So this is kind of Alito going ham by himself in his office, writing up what he would like to be the majority opinion. After this opinion, it has been written, it's circulated amongst the other justices, the ones who would join the opinion as well as the ones who would dissent. And then they would receive comments from the justices, both, you know, the ones who would join as well as the ones who would dissent, as well as the ones who would write concurrences. And the opinion would be edited in light of those responses. So this is really kind of a good indication of what the final opinion will be in June or July, whenever it's issued. But I think it's important to say that in the past, when these majority opinions or these draft opinions have circulated, sometimes we have defectors. So some justices who might have signed on to the majority opinion initially would think, you know, that's not the logic that I would have used, or I actually just disagree entirely. I actually think that the case should go the other way. So in the past, there have been defectors, and the majority opinion, the majority draft opinion ended up being the dissenting opinion. So this leak, it could ultimately not be the majority opinion, but it's likely that it would be. I think it's very unlikely that Kavanaugh, Barrett, Thomas, you know, the usual suspects would fail to join this.
Well, I mean, there's a chance that it's functionally the same, right? But with maybe some of Alito's language watered down a bit. From my understanding, he went off a little bit on liberals on past decisions. It was a cantankerous and aggressive opinion here. So perhaps someone like Kavanaugh, who's reportedly a bit more concerned with the PR blowback, might want to tweak it a bit in terms of the touch, but functionally the result could be the same. It's likely to be the same.
Yeah, I think that's a great word, cantankerous, to describe Alito. Yeah, and it might be softened, right? But the result is the same. We should expect the same result come June, which is overturning Roe. It might, you know, like you, as a race scholar, I noticed that Alito threw in some things about abortion being a technique of Black genocide, you know, had to throw that in there. So those things might ultimately, you know, hit the cutting room floor. But it's likely that the result will be the same, which is a decision to overturn Roe.
I don't want to spend too much time on this because I would rather get your take on some of those elements that's in his opinion, because it and give us a sense of where the court's going to go, you know, what the signals. But why do you have a sense of why someone would leak this?
Because up is down and right is left. Like, I just, like, the world is, like, we're living in a brand new world, right? Like, never in the history of the court am I aware that an opinion was leaked. So it's just like that the norms that are surrounding these institutions just have corroded. It's just an incredible norm of secrecy around the Supreme Court, around the decisions, around their logic. And so that is what the most powerful indication that I received is that our norms are corrupting. But you know, the motivation for it, you know, is this. You know, I think that there might be some truth to the claim that this is an attempt by those who want to see Roe overturned to stop any defectors from defecting, right? This is kind of like a way to get public just to know what, where the court is headed. And so if, let's say, both Roberts and Kavanaugh decided, you know what, I actually want to keep Roe at least for the next, you know, 10 to 15 years or something like that. Here's a, the public now knows that at some point they were both on board, you know, or one of them was, you know, was on board. I've also, you know, I think there might be some truth to the claim that this opinion was leaked in order to soften the blow of what is to come, you know, in the summer. Everybody's reporting it now, right? Everybody knows where the Supreme Court is headed. We knew before, but we know with certainty where the Supreme Court is headed. And so when the decision is actually handed down in June or July at some point this summer, you know, all of our expectations, you know, we know what to expect. And so it'll be less of a you know, perhaps a political blow, a social blow. So, you know, I think both of those possibilities are true.
And just to be clear, if Alito had been assigned this and wrote it in February, that means that basically at that time, Roe v. Wade is overturned. And the only thing that could happen, you know, for all intent, the only thing that could happen between that time and June is defectors, right? You're like, you're not going to have like, oh, you know, I've been sitting with this. Sonia Sotomayor is not going to be sitting there going, I've been sitting with this. I'm going to join the majority here.
Right.
I mean, it's like the only reason why you would want to do this is to lock in this result right now. And then maybe the ancillary benefit of, like you say, down the road, it softens the blow because now it's an old story by the time we get to June or July.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I don't know what Sotomayor's texting game is like, but she might be texting, you know, Barrett, and she might be texting Kavanaugh, trying to get them to, you know, see the light and come to what is currently the dissent. But that's highly unlikely. Right. Way back in February, there were at least five votes, probably six, but at least five votes to overturn Roe. And so this would be a sort of manifesto of the thinking at the time, at least Alito's version of the thinking.
Let's assume that the ruling stays more or less within the confines of what Alito has written. It may be softened at certain points, like you say. He may not be bringing up eugenic theories about eugenics as being the controlling reason why we have a legal abortion. What sticks out for you in terms of the reasoning that you find most problematic, egregious, or, you know, problematic going forward, egregious in terms of the reasoning?
I get hives. They break out on my body when I read originalist opinions. And so originalist opinions in the sense of, let's try to figure out what they were thinking back in 1787 or 1789. I get hives because I think it's a very silly exercise. Because most of the members of the body politic that we consider members of society just weren't at the table. They weren't thought of. They were, you know, actually excluded formally. So people of color weren't part of the bargaining. You know, they weren't part of negotiations. Women, you know, people with the capacity of pregnancy, they weren't part of the negotiations. And that's just sex and gender. Like, we can also talk about class. Like, unpropertied people were not part of the body politic. They weren't valued members of society. And so when we go back to try to figure out what they were thinking in 1787, they weren't thinking of those classes of people. So the Constitution at that point just looks like a document designed to protect the interests of propertied cis white males. And so, yeah, sure, of course, they didn't care about the abortion, right? They could care less about, you know, people's ability to control whether they become pregnant and whether they carry a pregnancy to term. So the most egregious aspect of the opinion to me is this, this normalization of trying to, of this originalist, you know, technique of interpreting the Constitution. It is not normal. It is abnormal to interpret the demands of today's Constitution in light of what a whole bunch of propertied cis white men wanted at the turn of the 18th century.
Yeah, and isn't inherent in this like originalist philosophy that you're also not supposed to be an activist, that you're supposed to defer to precedent? And according to this opinion, this is as activist as it gets.
Yeah, you know, so the theory is just really just politics kind of masquerading as, you know, serious legal thought. So the theory has come up with an approach to precedent that allows it to discard precedents that are egregiously wrong, right? So Justice Thomas has been writing in, you know, concurrences and dissents for as long as he's been on the court, kind of creating this body of doctrine that has not been precedential at all, but you know, he's been thinking about it out loud, in which it's consistent with originalism to discard precedents that are egregiously wrong, to discard precedents that do not align with the original meaning of the Constitution. So again, the legal theory is just, you know, politics dressed up as serious legal thought.
And in the way that Alito articulates this is he talks about the idea that it is wrong to believe that the Constitution has unenumerated rights. That is, rights that are not specifically laid out in the Constitution, but are that are derived from principles about the Constitution.
Right.
Right of privacy allows you to have, you know, a relationship with your doctor where your doctor provides, you know, contraceptive,
right.
That type of thing. And he goes through and he says, unless they are deeply rooted in American society. And as you say, like, they could have only been deeply rooted if they were really important to property owners, slave owners, frankly, in some instances, white men. And those are the only ones that are essentially, I mean, this is he's given away the game here a little bit, right? He's basically saying, like, we set this society up for a certain group of people to win. And those are we're going to abide by that. And that's basically it. What I don't ask this, obviously, like, I don't want this to be seen as diminishing the implications of this, because I think the implications of this are going to be huge, obviously.
Right.
But there's two parts to this ruling, right? There is the implications for abortion rights and then a whole host of other rights.
Yeah.
What are implicated in that second sort of tranche?
Yeah, so Alito casts skepticism, upon all unenumerated rights, and specifically substantive due process rights, and those are the rights that we have derived from the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Like, it's a long history. I won't, we don't have that much time, so I won't give you the history, but this goes back to like the 1900s, where the Supreme Court was interpreting the due process clause to protect rights, rights to privacy, rights to control the education of your children, right? Rights to custody of your children, rights to access contraception in the 1960s, rights of unmarried people to access contraception. So what Alito was saying is that all those decisions dating back to the 1900s, illegitimate, right? So that means that those rights are vulnerable now. They're threatened. And there's nothing that would stop the Supreme Court from holding that this, you know, Meyer versus Nebraska, this old case that said that you have a right to send your child to a school of your choice to get your child educated in the way that you want your child to be educated, that is a protected constitutional right. There's nothing that stops the Supreme Court from saying, well, that's substantive due process. That's trash. But looking forward, specifically in the 2000s, right, we started seeing the court use that same due process clause to protect the rights of LGBTQ people. So Lawrence versus Texas, which held that it was unconstitutional for Texas to criminalize, quote unquote, same-sex sodomy, that opinion relied on substantive due process. And so when Alito says these unenumerated rights, they're made up, they're trash, they don't really exist, Lawrence v. Texas stands in the crosshairs. It means that it would open the door for Texas and any other, you know, state to criminalize same-sex conduct, same-sex sexual activity. And then, of course, Obergefell versus Hodges built on Lawrence versus Texas. Obergefell versus Hodges being the Supreme Court case that held that the Constitution is properly interpreted to protect the ability of a person to marry another person of the same sex. So same-sex marriage, marriage equality, that stands in the crosshairs as well. So abortion, you know, Roe v. Wade is just the beginning. The Supreme Court, I think it's important for people to understand that the Supreme Court is the judicial arm of the GOP. The Supreme Court is not an independent body. It's not apolitical at all. And so what the GOP wants this conservative ideology, this conservative view of the country, the Supreme Court now stands prepared to sort of manifest it. And LGBTQ rights are likely the next to go. But I think it's important to recognize that all sort of reproductive liberties around accessing contraception, having children, not being coercively sterilized, those things are equally vulnerable from a constitutional standpoint.
But the fact that that Alito's opinion explicitly targets Lawrence v. Texas, or at least, you know, alludes to it in a very specific manner, it's kind of a bad signal for Republican legislators around the country, because look, we gave you runway to implement all of these very restrictive abortion laws, and now we are rewarding you. We are rewarding you with this opinion. And here embedded in my opinion, I'm giving you the damn roadmap to do this next. And this is the easiest way to get what you want. I mean, they're telling them in this opinion, do this next.
Right. Absolutely. It's kind of like back in December, in September, actually, when the Supreme Court allowed Texas SB 8 to go into effect. It was kind of just like, I see what you did there. Go ahead, keep doing it. We're not actually going to stop you. And so Texas is like, cool, we'll just, you know, make sure that nobody gets abortions in the state past 6 weeks indefinitely. And then all these other states, you know, followed the lead. And so, you know, Kentucky passed restrictive abortion legislation. Everybody's queuing up, having read the clear signs from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's not going to stop anti-abortion legislation, not going to stop anti-abortion restrictions, or rather abortion restrictions. And so this the signal, you know, it takes a lot to not see the signs in Alito's draft opinion that he's opening the door to, okay, focus next on Lawrence versus Texas. Right. Focus next on Obergefell. He's making it very plain that he doesn't believe that those decisions were correctly decided. The justices that sign on to Alito's opinion will be indicating that they don't think that those decisions were correctly decided, were correct interpretations of the Constitution. And so now it's an invitation for red states to, okay, see what you can do, right? Like, maybe stop issuing marriage licenses. Maybe stop allowing LGBTQ families to adopt. Maybe, you know, let's play with it a little bit, see how far you can get before you get a decision in which the Supreme Court overturns it entirely.
So on that day in June or possibly early July when this decision is announced, it may not be Alito's brief as we've read it today, but it is almost certainly going to be a 5-4 decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. 26 states, is my understanding, essentially in that moment will have a ban on abortion. There may be some slight variation between those bans, but basically abortion is done. Connecticut just passed a law. It's about to be signed, I think, by Lamont, that was aimed at protecting people who left, let's say, for instance, state of Texas and going to Connecticut, so they could countersue and get back all the money that they would lose if they were sued by out of Texas, and it protects them. But I have two questions, and these are the two final questions. One, can a Connecticut create a law that would inhibit Texas' ability to have their law follow that Texas citizen to Connecticut to get an abortion, let's say, A? And B, what can a state do? We haven't really contemplated this, but this is something to contemplate. In 2024, even if the Democrats hold the Senate in 2022, they have the odds are against them in 2024. The House is probably going to be gone by 2024. It's not impossible to imagine that Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis or whomever it is going to be president when the Republicans get all three branches of government. They could pass a federal ban on abortion. Is there anything the states can do in that instance?
No. Well, I have to think more about it, but what you are suggesting is absolutely likely. And the Democrats should have been planning for this possibility. I think that for so long we have been sort of leaning on the existence of Roe v. Wade, right? We had been just assuming, Supreme Court justice confirmations have been around whether a justice would or would not vote to uphold Roe v. Wade. So for so long, we have been relying on the Supreme Court's decision and abortion being protected as a constitutional right. With the demise of Roe in the summer, in a month or so, it now leaves the political branches open to do what they do. And I think that we are fools to believe that the next step in the abortion fight is not, or the next goal for Republicans when it comes to abortion is not a federal statute banning abortion in the U.S. entirely, right? If you believe that the fetus is a life, you're not satisfied with a life being protected in Texas but killed in California. If you believe that abortion is murder, you shouldn't stop until this murder isn't happening all over the country. And so that's what a federal law, a federal piece of legislation would do, would be to prescribe abortion across the country. At that point, what could states do? I think it's states could do very little, like when you're facing a federal ban on abortion. But I think it takes creativity to respond to something like that, right? So since 1973, we've had federal license to get an abortion. And so, anti-abortion folks have had to operate within the constraints of that law. And I got to say, they did it quite creatively and ingenious, and they did a great job since 1973 in whittling down the abortion right to where it stands today, which is not very good. And now this not very protective right that we have is about to be overturned. So I think that folks who support abortion rights have to be just as creative as anti-abortion folks have been since 1973. They were operating under a federal regime that they didn't like. They did a great job to make abortion inaccessible. So we may be operating under a federal regime that we don't like, and we're going to have to do, act creatively to make abortion accessible to those who need it.
Kiara Bridges, law professor at UC Berkeley School of Law. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break, and our next guest is going to talk directly to that. What happens when a state ban or a federal ban on abortion happens in this country? What's it going to look like on the ground? We'll be right back when we talk to Michelle Oberman, professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program Michelle Oberman. She is a professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law. And Professor, thanks for joining us. We were just talking to Professor Akira Bridges from the UC Berkeley School of Law. And we left it on the question of what happens if there's a federal ban. And your work has focused on what does happen when there are abortion bans, both in this country and in internationally, and what the implications are, the real world implications. Let me just start, though, and welcome to the program. What was it like pre-Roe? I mean, I think we have this notion that it was, I mean, like, how, what was that dynamic?
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny thing to have our set point be what life was like more than 50 years ago, right? But it's worth noticing that at every point in history, folks who have money have been able to pretty safely end their abortions. So folks with money in the years prior to Roe would find either access by flying to jurisdictions where abortion was legal or more readily accessible. So you had wealthy women flying to Europe, or could, but because they knew their doctors and they had better access to them, could find a doctor who could safely end their pregnancies here. The thing that's changed and changed dramatically in the past 50 years, and that you see really throughout the world, even in the poorest countries in the world, is that the availability of a safe, affordable, and effective means of ending a pregnancy in the form of abortion medicine has just completely changed the risks for the rest of us, right? So in a country like El Salvador, where the majority of the population lives on less than $5 a day, wealthy women can still get on a plane and fly to New York or Miami for a surgical abortion. But the vast majority of folks are ending unwanted pregnancies by accessing, just through a cell phone, a market in abortion medicine.
And so,
and getting an abortion pill, just to clarify, I think you cut out a little bit. Yeah. Okay.
No, I mean, we haven't really thought through what comes next in this country, but in countries all over the world, folks with cell phones and a debit card are able to access a market in, you know, illegal abortion medicines, and provided that they have the guidance to know that it's the right drug, they're taking it at the right time, and they've got the right dose, they're safely ending their pregnancies. It's like 92% to 98% effective.
Okay, and so and you know, I read over a paper you wrote, "What will and won't happen when abortion is banned in this country?" And you looked at basically three assumptions about how bans work. A ban will actually be effective in deterring abortion, that it will send a message about abortion and sort of, I guess, change the cultural narrative around it. And third, that these bans will be enforced by everyone. And the reason why I wanted to ask about pre-1973, because I feel like, well, first off, is there any precedent for a ban on abortion to return, particularly after, like, you know, several generations? I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing, like, we've overturned a ban on abortion in, you know, and then 2 years later it was reinstated or something. But this has now been, like, I think that the impact of this is mitigated on some level because people can't really conceive of abortion being outright banned, and it can be, but is there a precedent for a ban to return like this?
No, there isn't. And as you're suggesting, the world has really changed in the past 50 years. And, you know, in many ways, some of the most important of those changes are changes that involve the status of women in civil society, right? I mean, prior to Roe, women seldom had credit cards, didn't necessarily hold credit cards or have access to their own cash. We didn't fly on airplanes, right? It was very expensive to travel across state lines. We weren't well represented in the academy, in the legal profession, in the medical profession, right? So much has changed. to my mind, what I find helpful when I wonder how you can actually go from something that's legal and that's widely available and used to something that is now illegal, I actually think a lot about prohibition and what happened in this country when we took alcohol and made it, woof, suddenly like this thing that everybody's able to do is now illegal. And what we learn from that history is that in the immediate aftermath of prohibition, there was this moment of like the market freezing up. How are we going to access alcohol? But you have to pay attention to the demand side of a market to understand what happens next, which is when there's a demand for alcohol, then pretty quickly the market adjusts and people figure out how they're going to get alcohol. And so ultimately it became a joke, a very unpopular law and a bit of a joke, and the market responded. And my gut is that we're going to see the same thing here. And it's not just my gut. I mean, unless we think, wow, they figured it out in El Salvador and they figured it out in Brazil, but in the United States, we're not going to have a market in illegal abortion. Like, unless we think that's true, then the only real question for folks on both sides is what's that illegal market going to look like?
Well, the fact that it's a market, right, I think that raises a whole bunch of questions, because it's healthcare, but in this country we've decided that healthcare is a commodity or something that, you know, you need to that is privatized, so a different, you know, road to go down there. But I just was hoping that you could expand on the fact that even with abortion being legal, restricted in red states, but legal in this country, it's so difficult for poor and particularly non-white women in this country to access abortion. Now it's going to be a whole another set of hurdles, as you lay out, although this is a very different landscape, as you also say. I don't know if people are fully understanding of all of these obstacles that poor women face, one, in accessing contraception, and then also accessing abortion that leads to this disproportionately affecting them. Do you mind laying that out for the audience?
Yeah, I love your question. I'm glad you raised it. I feel like it is, to my mind, immoral to talk about abortion without talking about class and race in America. And the reason why it's immoral is because these bans will differentially impact the poorest among us, and the poorest among us are disproportionately Black and Brown women, right? And let's just be clear about that. Right. Let's talk about what kind of access they have to health care and to contraception, which are the things that actually are associated with lower abortion rates. Access to contraception is actually associated with lower abortion rates. So I think that for folks who are hoping that the bans will deter abortion, what they are actually hoping is the same thing that they were hoping back in 1976 when Congress, in response to Roe, passed a law that said you could restrict Medicaid funding of abortions. And so from the very beginning, we've taken poor women and their access to abortion and made the right an abstraction, right? If you don't have the money, you don't actually have access to abortion. So to sort of loop all the way back to, okay, like what happens next? I think what happens on the ground in red states is that folks who have the money or the education will figure out how to get online and access the drugs that they need to end an unwanted pregnancy, or where to go in their car, or how to get a bus or a plane to get themselves to a state where they can have a legal surgical abortion. The folks who are most likely to be impacted or deterred by abortion are those who are struggling to navigate on a day-to-day basis their lives already with a child, right? 60% of abortions go to folks who already have a child, with perhaps a minimum wage job, living on around $14,000 a year. The federal poverty line, right, is like $14,000 a year, and half of abortions go to people living below that. Right? So we're talking about that population figuring out how to access an abortion, whether it's through medicine or through travel. And it just feels to me like those are the folks that are going to have the biggest struggle. And when they struggle and when they are forced to continue their pregnancies, what we're going to see is an increase in child poverty in this country.
Right. Do you think that because that the enforcement mechanisms and the incentive structure for enforcement is going to be different than it was pre-1973, because it occurs to me that the reinstitution of this ban is going to bring with it, particularly in the red states, but if the Republicans get control of the presidency and certainly the Senate and the House, and we get a federal ban, I think like the DOJ, the number one department they're going to have is going to be, you know, civil rights division is going to be dedicated to going after people who infringe upon the rights of fetuses, essentially. And it sounds flippant, but I mean, I think this is actually the way it's going to work. The fervor in which they're going to go for prosecutions, and undoubtedly it's going to be a class distinction, although maybe every now and then they'll go after, you know, some Hollywood lib if they can or something to that effect. But we're going to see there's an incentive structure for prosecution and enforcement that I think is going to be far more energized than it was pre-1973.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right, but I think that energy is going to be very short-lived. And here's why. When you ask a woman why she's ending a pregnancy, pretty quickly what comes into view is not sort of I really want to wear a bikini this summer, but I can't afford to have this child. The guy is long gone. I'm living on too little money. There is no paid parental leave in this country. Where am I supposed to leave my child for daycare when my minimum wage job has no flexibility? I'm 17 years old and it is too hard to access a living wage. Right. So what comes into view when you try to prosecute abortion is the struggle to figure out who's the perpetrator, right? Who's the bad guy here? And that's why these prosecutions have just never been terribly popular, whether it's in El Salvador, where they really try full scale and, you know, abortion prosecutions, or whether it's actually, or whether it's going to be in this country. I mean, it just historically, it's never been a popular prosecution. The reason why I think we see disproportionately prosecutions going against the poorest and most marginalized in the country, we see these prosecutions already, is because prosecutors have to figure out what they think their juries will actually convict. Right, so the senator's daughter is not going to be a popular prosecution, even though in many ways that would be at least a more just prosecution than going after the poor black woman who's living on nothing and has three babies.
I mean, I hope you're right about that, but I think there is a fervor that is, and they are playing to a narrow enough audience. Right. Like, I mean, that was the reason why we said you didn't hear this agenda on a national level. But then what started happening is you started having congressional districts and states that were like, there is no contrary opinion. There is nobody we can go after in this instance that's not going to feed into the narrative we have. And I wonder if that level of zealotry and the fact that it's self-sustaining, because we're not only going to have a ban on abortion, I think, federally at one point in the next 4 or 5 years, very possibly, let's put it that way, but we're also going to have minoritarian rule.
Yeah.
And so the idea that 60% of the population is not behind your virulent prosecution of people who are seeking abortion may be largely irrelevant to them maintaining political power. In fact, it may be the opposite. It's like, we just need to make sure that 40% is with us. And so there is no unpopular, prosecution of abortion in that regard. I just wonder, I mean, you're the expert. That's why I ask.
Well, I mean, none of us is expert on what comes next, right? I mean, you know, it's hard to know what appetite prosecutors will have and what appetite the country will have. The way I think about prosecution and full-scale enforcement against something that is this, against something like abortion that is this commonplace, that one in four of us actually has one in our lifetime, is to think about the opioid epidemic. I mean, you can't prosecute your way out of something that is so endemic. Everybody's life is touched by it. And so I think there'll be short-term bursts of enthusiasm by rogue prosecutors in small red jurisdictions, and that pretty quickly it'll catch somebody's daughter, and there'll suddenly be folks that are rabidly anti-choice, right? That are rabidly supporting the bans, having a hesitation around conviction.
your optimist, more optimistic take than my black belt take is refreshing. But I wonder how many non-white poor women who will fall before that happens. I mean, I will never underestimate the right's ability to be cruel and demonize women and punish them for their sexuality and then criminalize poverty as well. And those two things, when it comes to this abortion issue, it's they're right for the right for the picking. So
yeah, I'm 100% with you there. I think the answer is that women who look like me need to put our bodies on the line. I mean, it just, you know, that we can't stand and sit idly and allow them to take the fall.
Yeah.
Along those lines, what from your research have you found have been the most effective mechanisms that have been deployed to fight bans, both materially insofar as like providing the access to the extent that it can be with a ban, and also politically in terms of like undercutting the existence of the ban politically?
So I think the answer to that question comes by centering the needs of the most marginalized and vulnerable. And when you start by asking how they'll be affected, then you can actually build out a response. And I've watched this happen on the ground in El Salvador, where what they did was they centered, okay, who's actually being affected by this? And they realized, oh, wow, so there's patients in the hospital setting and doctors who are afraid. And the doctors who are afraid are reporting the patients to the police, or they're undertreating things like cancer, right, like an ectopic pregnancy. And so they mounted a strategy to first begin to sue doctors who breached confidentiality, and secondly, to begin to articulate malpractice when doctors were, you know, undertreating cancer. So that's a small example. Bigger example was, let's look and see what's happening with the folks who are being prosecuted, and then begin to build out the cases around wrongful convictions, because those folks ended up, of course, there, as they will here, being the poorest folks in the country, poorly represented by lawyers who were incompetent, convicted by judges who were sloppy. So they put a team of lawyers on those cases, and they've had an exoneration rate that is astonishing. In the past 10 years, they've found close to 30 cases of women who've been exonerated as fully innocent and sent home from prison, right? The majority of cases of women serving sentences in El Salvador have now been exonerated. And then in terms of the most important impact, building on the ground, it's to create safe places to go when you're struggling with an unwanted pregnancy. So it's not just that you need to be able to use your phone and some money to access drugs. You need to find somebody who can tell you, this is the right drug, this is the right time to take it, this is what to do when you go to the hospital if you have, this is what's abnormal, what would cause you to have so much bleeding to go to the hospital, this is what to tell the doctor. So we need trusted advisors. They don't have to be professionals, but trusted advisors to walk us through it. Think about abortion doulas, you might call them, right? We have that movement here. It just hasn't been scaled up. But that's what we need. We need something to combat the misinformation. And I think we'll save the most vulnerable in that way. But if we're just worried about how are wealthy white women going to survive without a right, then we're really missing the import of this moment.
So it's conceivable we could see a network of these abortion doulas and people like just basically putting billboards up, across the country, text 503, whatever it is, to get more information type of situation.
Yeah, I mean, like it already exists. There already are chat lines and text lines. I think that what we need is actually a scaled up that's not just like billboards, but that is interpersonal, right? I think about like wearing a button that rather than having a coat hanger, it has pills on it, right? Like, here I am, I'm safe, ask me. I just don't see any way around it. And I know from COVID misinformation and from this world in which we've got so much misinformation around vaccination, that it's going to be a challenge. It's not a simple problem. And that's why I think it's very interpersonal. Like, it can't just be, here's a billboard. It has to be, here am I, you trust me, and I can walk you through this.
Right. I really appreciate your insight for this. It's it's a horrible day, but it really is not just a day. I mean, that is the point. It is going forward. Michelle Oberman, professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law, really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emma.
All right.
Fun halftime.
Yeah, folks. Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is the thing, too, is that, like, I am quite convinced that this leak was done to, you know, maybe both lock in votes and to certainly depreciate the strength of the pushback, because it's not like this is, you know, remember, this is like what Bill Barr did with the Mueller report. Came out, provided a definition before the report came out, made it impossible for the report itself to be digested as it actually was, started the narrative there. If the narrative goes from, you know, Alito's version of the 5-4 to like Kavanaugh's version of the 5-4, where it's not, that's going to be the story. I mean, I'm willing to bet at least portion of Miles. Well, let's do Saul's, because okay. Saul's got more. I got more time
more
to make
runway,
it up
right?
Of his college fund. That what we're going to see by the New York Times and the Washington Post when the decision is revealed, that it's going to be anti-abortion 5-4, but not as harsh as it at first glean. But in fact, it will be as harsh.
But I don't find value in looking at. I don't think this is going to do much to dilute the opposition to Roe v. Wade getting overturned. We could pick apart the politics of like Edward Snowden and what was the motivation behind his leaking of things. And yet, it is still heroic and material. I'm not saying this was heroic, but it was still very important for us to have that information. We don't know how things are going to shake out. I don't respect the institution of the court. I don't respect the norms. I don't particularly care if a liberal opinion gets out early or if a conservative one gets out early. This one is so monumental that, you know.
Well, I guess from my perspective,
it's incredibly newsworthy.
I'm not disagreeing. Well, of course it's newsworthy, but I'm not disagreeing with, you know, that I'm worried about the institution of the court. I mean, I think just, you know. I'm not trying to protect norms in it. I'm saying this is disadvantageous. This is a disadvantage for those who are against the 5-4 ruling. That's my point. And I mean, it remains to be seen, but that's what I'm guessing. We are going to head into the fun half of the program. We're going to welcome Nomi Const, who might have a couple of thoughts about this.
Maybe.
Just a reminder, it is your support that helps this program survive and thrive. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the fun half, or the free half, free of commercials, you get the so-called fun half, which is on occasion fun.
Today
probably not so much.
Well, we'll see.
Maybe.
I'm trying to look at the sound sheet to see if there's literally even anything that's fun on here. There's some fun stuff.
But it's always an endeavor. Also, come out, see the Boston show live. We are 2 weeks away, less than 2 weeks away. You don't want to miss this. We've got great music. We've got great discussion about, I imagine we're going to be talking about Roe v. Wade with Natalie Shore and we're going to be talking to some environmental activists doing some work up in Boston. We've got a special guest. It's going to be great. And there's going to be hundreds of your fellow Majority Report listeners or watchers. So check it out. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, tomorrow on Left Reckoning, we're having Robin Wansley-Warloba on. She's an independent socialist who is a city councilor for Minnesota's Ward 2, and we're going to be talking about running electorally, being an independent socialist and not seeking the Democratic endorsement, and what she sees as her role in politics, and we'll probably talk about policing and housing as well as this abortion stuff.
All right, let's bring Nomi on so she can tell us what's happening on her program. Hi, Nomi. Great
Hello,
day.
Hello, guys. How are you? It's casual Tuesday for me today. I just couldn't really get myself motivated to do much this morning. So, no show this week. I'm off. But because of the news, I've seen a lot of people say, where can we give money? What can we do? There are a lot of abortion access funds that are doing amazing work. But I do want to remind people that we have red legislatures that the Democrats have abandoned in so much of this country. And Matriarch is supporting more women, probably, I think, more women are running than ever and have been since Trump has been elected. But they've also not been receiving the resources needed. And we need to take over those legislatures. So if you are kind enough to contribute to Matriarch PAC, you can go to matriarchpac.com. We just announced 8 endorsements. We have many more rolling out. We're doing emergency calls coming up for women, all working class women, let's be very clear, progressive women running from all the way to the local level, to like city council, state house, to Congress. And, you know, because obviously, listen, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second because this is dangerous territory, but the strategy has got to change. I mean, there have been so many books written about the strategy.
There is a strategy that exists now?
Yeah, it's called show up at a protest, then go home and feel better. Maybe if the Democrats, if women's groups, and maybe this is what we'll call on, is that they demand that the Democratic Party exist outside of Washington, New York, and California so that this wouldn't happen to so many, let's be real. I mean, it's beyond actually just poor women now. This is, you know, if you're in any of the southern states, either you jump on a plane, which is very dangerous in some cases, or you have to drive through how many states to get abortion access. Obviously, that requires resources, but it also requires time. So this is hurting, you know, the poorest communities the most, but it is all trickling up to hit, you know, higher economic classes as well. So we've got to take over these legislatures. It's ridiculous because some of these races really don't cost that much money, and there are effing right-wing Trump QAnon supporters running to take over the legislatures now. And if we don't see that in front of us because we live in our own little bubbles, it's time to start paying attention and demanding Democrats and institutional women's organizations put pressure because the Democrats do listen to them. So if you're funding Planned Parenthood, if you're funding Emily's List, if you're funding any of these organizations, NARAL, who are our allies, demand that they actually, I don't know, open up an office in Texas or Arizona. They have offices there, but it's extremely underfunded. So we've got to start supporting women at the local level.
All right.
Doesn't Emily's List support Kyrsten Sinema? Or they left her earlier in January. I was about to be like, well, we could talk about her statement in a minute about how she's still a poll.
Let's see if Clyburn is going to his event with Cuellar.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about Pelosi's, all of this in the fun half. I just want to remind people, if you're watching the program live, you can go into the YouTube description and click on the link that we're going to put up right now. It's up to get to the fun half, which we are headed towards right now. So the fun half is on a different YouTube stream. Click on it. Oh, and I also just want to say, we have people watching on Twitch, and yesterday, I felt the presence of it, the energy of it, but I didn't say anything because I wasn't quite sure what was happening.
You felt the four level, the four tiered train.
I'm sorry, we had a level 5 hype train
sorry.
Yesterday.
Choo choo.
Yeah, we had a level 5 hype train on
I don't
on Twitch.
Any of this.
Arduin, Asian, Siri Business. And Nug Wrangler, all gifted
Nug
5
Wrangler.
Subscription each. That was that brought us up to a level 5 hype train. And that's why
all aboard.
It was so nuts. I got a little nauseous and I wasn't quite sure what it was. I thought maybe I was not fully recovered from my COVID. And then I found out it was a level 5.
Yeah, you can feel that energy anywhere.
See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow,
What? What is that going on? It's nuts! Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Unpacked. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked. What is up, everyone?
Unpacked.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late. And the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.